this play was an epic story about the very nature of America. And at the heart of that story are gay people. And its protagonist, its everyman figure, is an effeminate gay man with AIDS.
This book was written by Dharma Kelleher, who was heralded as one of the top authors in transgender crime fiction.
When we started reporting the article that would turn into this book, Donald Trump was a joke. We got about halfway through working on the book, and he was the next president of the United States.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Seoul's Queer Culture Fest parade shrivels opposition, a trans mystery hero jinxes the bad guys, and Angel spreads its wings for a backstage book. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 21st, 2018. A petition circulating in South Korea demanded that the government stop the LGBTQ Pride Parade in Seoul on July 14th. More than 200,000 people supported the failed effort. And despite stifling heat close to 33 degrees Celsius, or 92 degrees Fahrenheit, organizers said some 120,000 sexual and gender-variant minorities and their supporters marched in the start to the week-long 19th Seoul Queer Culture Festival, breaking all previous records. The name Seoul was added to the title this year because similar events have now been or are being held in at least five other South Korean cities. Outnumbered by about 500 police officers dispatched to keep the peace, members of various conservative religious groups gathered nearby to chant and hold signs calling same-gender love a sin. A few laid down on the hot pavement for a few moments in a symbolic attempt to stop the Rainbow Riders Motorcycle Club from kicking off the parade. Several foreign dignitaries marched, and nine of the 105 pre-parade booths were staffed by the embassies of Australia, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Ireland, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, the UK, and the US, plus the European Union's delegation to South Korea and the National Human Rights Commission of Korea, the only South Korean government agency to participate. The parade's chief organizer, identified only as Kang by the English language Joongang Daily, said that Korean society may look stagnant because the opposition has the loudest voice, but society is continuously changing, and we will eventually hear more voices calling for progress.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, passed up the chance to meet with Donald Trump, who was golfing at one of his Scottish resorts during his recent European trip, to become the first leader of a UK government to lead an LGBTQ pride parade, this one on July 14th in Glasgow. Sturgeon has been a sharp critic of the US president, and it should come as no surprise that he reportedly dislikes her. It should also come as no surprise that Trump himself was greeted by noisy protesters wherever he went in Europe. The only Glasgow Pride disappointment came when organizers had to apologize to hundreds of ticket holders to the post-parade festival at Kelvin Grove Park, who were turned away after the crowd reached maximum legal capacity. Addressing the record-breaking post-parade rally of more than 12,000 people and wearing a rainbow-colored Choose Love t-shirt, Sturgeon said that she was genuinely proud to be there. Scotland values tolerance. Scotland values diversity. Scotland values respect for all, she said, and above all, Scotland values love. She also told the crowd that she's tickled by reports that Trump hates her and has even been bitching about her to British Prime Minister Theresa May. If it's true, I suppose I should take it as a compliment, she said. I certainly don't spend that much time talking about him. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Ireland's openly gay PM Leo Varadkar have previously led pride parades in their respective countries.
Equality supporters in Israel plan to hold an unprecedented nationwide strike on July 22nd to protest the exclusion of same-gender couples from reforms to surrogacy laws approved by the Knesset, or parliament, late last week. The queer community's major national advocacy group, AGUDA, wrote on its Facebook page that on that day, workers from the community and likewise our supporters and partners will not be present at work and will close their businesses to protest the blatant discrimination against the LGBT community. Large street demonstrations in both Jerusalem and Tel Aviv were held to protest the parliamentary snub within hours of the vote. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been a particular target for having declared his support for the right of single men to use a surrogate, which many believe would effectively have allowed surrogacy for same-gender couples, and 2 days later, under political pressure from the far-right elements of his coalition government, voted against that idea and with the majority to extend surrogacy rights only to single women. Such services until now have only been available to infertile married heterosexual couples. Opposition parties were quick to call Netanyahu cowardly and spineless.
The effort to open surrogacy to queer Israeli couples has gained the support of several corporate giants. Microsoft is offering to help cover the cost of international surrogacy, the only option now available, which is both expensive and fraught with legal obstacles to any gay or lesbian Israeli employee interested in starting a family through surrogacy. Mellanox Technologies is offering similar financial assistance, in addition to a month off for parental leave, and said it would allow its workers to participate in the July 22nd strike. Procter & Gamble said it would allow its workers to join the strike without having to take a vacation day to do it. So did local branches of Facebook, IBM, and eBay. Israel's third largest carrier, Israel Airlines, said it would allow staff to wear black on the day of the strike to show their solidarity. Leading carrier, El Al Airlines, issued a statement of support for its employees who want to participate in the strike. And the country's airports authority warned of probable flight delays because of the work stoppage.
Delegates to the General Convention of the Episcopal Church, meeting this week in Austin, Texas, overwhelmingly approved a resolution to allow gay and lesbian couples to get married in the diocese of their choice, whether or not the bishop approves. Bishops in 8 of the church's 109 dioceses have until now been allowed to ban those weddings, even if other clergy in the diocese are happy to officiate them. Shortly after the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling, delegates to the last General Convention in 2015, it's a triennial event, voted to allow church weddings, but also gave dissenting bishops the option of refusing to sanction them. Individual members of the clergy can still refuse to wed a gay or lesbian couple, but they will now have to refer the couple to another priest or bishop who's willing to perform the sacrament. A member of the queer-inclusive All Sacraments for All People movement within the Episcopal Church told the Tennessean newspaper her state's bishop has been among those refusing to marry queer couples, that it was a wonderful compromise which respects the dignity of the bishop and his position, but still allows marriage for all in their home congregations. The resolution affecting some 2 million Episcopalians won't come into force until the first Sunday of Advent, December 2nd.
The Supreme Court of India wrapped up hearings this week in a challenge to Penal Code Section 377, which criminalizes private consensual adult same-gender sex as a crime against nature. A ruling is expected before the end of September. Many court observers said the hearings went well for the repeal side, and some are predicting a unanimous decision striking down the antiquated law once and for all. A few are predicting that the 5-judge panel will go even further and order some specific non-discrimination protections. Decriminalization in India could also begin a domino effect of repeal of similar anti-gay sex laws inherited from British colonial rule in half of some 70 other countries. India is the world's second most populous nation. As veteran queer journalist Rex Wagner has noted, a favorable ruling will decriminalize 18% of all the LGBT people on the planet. Nearly 1 in 5 LGBT people on Earth no longer being criminals, he wrote, would probably qualify as one of the top 10 LGBT news stories of all time.
And finally, you may remember the Battle for Saipan from your days in history class as having been among the bloodiest of World War II, claiming tens of thousands of lives on both sides. Saipan is now the capital of the Northern Mariana Islands, which has been a Commonwealth of the United States ever since. Mayor David Apatang bragged this week that tourism is booming on the northwestern Pacific Ocean Island, thanks in large part to gay and lesbian couples from other countries who've been coming to Saipan since the U.S. Supreme Court declared marriage equality the law of the land in all 50 states and in its territories. The mayor has personally married several couples, including one from Bangladesh, but the majority of couples come from China, and he's married a few of those couples too. Others have come from South Korea and Russia. According to data issued by the mayor's office, of the 117 marriage licenses issued from January to June of this year in Saipan, 90 were to same-gender couples, 61 were female couples, and 29 were male. The boom goes on despite the recent increase in marriage license fees. It's $130 for residents, but now $250 for non-residents. Apatang pointed out that the marriages nevertheless continue to add up. Instead of 3 and 4 every day, he said, we increased it from 5 to 6. That's more revenue for us. The mayor said he'll use the marriage equality tourism income to continue beautification projects on the islands.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending July 21st, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap, From This Way Out, is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the new and improved thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
Updating our story on Israel's nationwide strike over the exclusion of gay and lesbian couples under the new surrogacy law, thousands of people demonstrated throughout the day on July 22nd. Protesters blocked traffic in Jerusalem, Haifa, Beersheba, and other cities. One activist reported that a car tried to ram into the amassed demonstrators. 2 or 3 people were arrested outside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's home. The day's events were capped by a rally of 60,000 at Rabin Square in Tel Aviv.
Roy Cohn, who's a character in this play, was Donald Trump's mentor, and Donald Trump learned his tactics directly from Roy Cohn.
Later in the program, shake hands with the devil. Very small hands. This Way Out queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason goes noir with a trans feminist bounty hunter in Dharma Kelleher's Chaser.
Despite the fact that I'm still filled with lesbian rage, I am a nonviolent person, if not by nature, then by principle. But at the same time, I have to admit that a woman hero avenging injustice gives me a little thrill. Lately, I've developed an intellectual reasoning to this. We need more feminist heroines. We need to keep believing that a woman protecting other women is possible, and we need to keep thinking that it's important. Reading Chaser, a Jinx Blue novel published in 2018 by Pariah Press, furthered my thinking on this. This book was written by Dharma Kelleher, who is heralded as one of the top authors in transgender crime fiction. I don't ordinarily read mysteries, but when I do, I am impressed with the suspense and tension inherent in the form, and I always learn something new. As a non-mystery reader, I found that the book was delightful and suspenseful, a page-turner with heart. The narrator, Jinx Ballou, is a bounty hunter hired to bring a teenage disabled girl, charged with her mother's murder, back to face her charges in court. The girl has skipped bail, which is why Jinx was hired to find her. Jinx takes on this case after she is outed by a local newspaper as transgender and is fired by her former agency. Jinx is astounded to discover that her employer is small-minded. As the author writes, I sighed, even as my heart revved in my chest like a race car engine. I've always been a girl, Sarah Jean. It's just that through some crazy mix-up, biochemistry, or genetics, I was born with a boy's body. It's hard to explain. She fixed her gaze on me once again. Ain't nothing to explain. Boys is boys and girls is girls. God made you what you are. Ain't no changing it. I wish it were that simple, Sarah Jane, but it's not. Perverts like yous, what's wrong with this world? Making it dangerous for God-fearing folks to use public restrooms. A pervert? Seriously, Sarah Jane, is that you think I am? I rolled my eyes. Want to know what trans people do in public restrooms? We pee, we poop, and we wash our hands, which is more than I can say for some people. And so the author proves her point. Discrimination that can be proven with a prohibition of the use of public restrooms is absolutely ridiculous. Jinx goes on to find new work and gets her girl, who she develops great empathy toward. While doing so, she confronts a mobster running a human trafficking operation. I observe that in many ways this novel contains many mysteries, including who outed Jinx to the reporter and why should the fact that she is transgender matter anyway. And so I learned a lot from Chaser, but perhaps most of all I learned that yes, given the right circumstances, I can count myself as a fan of crime fiction. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Hey everybody, this is Leah Delaria, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Until this play, there really was no major work of drama, literature, or film where the person who had AIDS at the beginning of the story was alive at the end of the story.
The play is alive and well, too, and its story continues after this. That golden oldie is just one tune you may recall when this Rainbow Minute celebrates a golden era.
The power of women's music, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Women's music was about advancing feminism, giving a voice to lesbians, and promoting women in the recording industry. The first National Women's Music Festival took place in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois in 1974. Relative Unknowns were set to perform early during the week-long festival, with the Saturday show headlined by Roberta Flack and Yoko Ono. When they canceled at the last minute, festival organizers scrambled to save the show. They assembled several of the lesser-known artists, Chris Williamson, Meg Christian, Vicki Randall, and Margie Adam, who quickly put an act together. By pulling off a showstopper, these four women personified empowerment, the very definition of women's music. In the process, they became revered icons of the genre. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Sonia, of Disappear Fear.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Angels in America ended its limited engagement 25th anniversary revival rerun on Broadway on July 15th. Tony Kushner's epic 1993 play and the 2001 HBO televised version directed by Mike Nichols has won a long list of awards, including several Tonys, Golden Globes, Emmys, and a Pulitzer. The curtain may have rung down on the latest performances, but the experience lives on in The World Only Spins Forward, an oral history of the play by Slate editor Dan Coyes and director-writer Isaac Butler. Butler sat down with John Shuck of Progressive Spirit at KBOO Portland to talk about the book and the play's striking relevance to the present.
Perhaps most relevantly to politics today, the real-life figure of Roy Cohn is a character in the play. And a lot of people have forgotten who Roy Cohn was, but Roy Cohn was a lawyer who helped prosecute Ethel and Julius Rosenberg and made sure they got the chair. He was involved in the HUAC with McCarthy. He was one of McCarthy's, part of McCarthy's crew as a lawyer. And then he went into private practice where he represented a lot of mobsters like John Gotti and also represented and became a mentor to our current president of the United States, Donald Trump. He was a Republican fixer, power broker, extremely powerful behind the scenes mover and shaker, whose career was destroyed when he contracted AIDS, which, you know, also outed him as being gay. And there was a story that sort of outed him as someone who had AIDS and was gay, and he died not that long after that story came out. And so you see sort of his journey from diagnosis through to death. He's kind of this stage devil figure. You know, he gets like all the best lines, and he's very entertaining, but he's also this repulsive figure of evil.
He is bully, coward, victim. That was said about him on the AIDS quilt.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. There's an AIDS quilt panel for Roy. And it says Roy Cohn, bully, coward, victim. And, you know, one of the things that Kushner really had in mind when he was making the character and that he struggled with was how to embody that whole dialectic, how to make him a bully, a coward, and a victim all at once.
And do you feel that Tony Kushner kind of got the real Roy Cohn right?
Well, you know, Nathan Lane says in the book that Kushner's Roy Cohn is probably smarter and funnier than the real guy, right? Yeah. I mean, it is very much a stage creation. It says in the foreword to the play that this is a fictional creation. I mean, among other things, I believe, if I remember correctly, the real-life Roy Cohn went to Walter Reed in D.C. for treatment, whereas, you know, in the play, he's in New York City at St. Vincent's. So there's a lot of stuff that's changed about him. At the same time, I think there is an essence and a truth at the core of Roy that Tony Kushner captured.
And of course, the essence and the truth of what Roy represented in many ways. You know, the person, as he says, and you quoted in the book, and I remember the wonderful line where he says, "I'm not a homosexual. Homosexuals, you know, don't know anybody, and nobody knows them. I'm not that. I'm me." You know, so there's an essence in which art can really bring even the deeper sense of an everyman quality to all of these characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of everyman, I mean, one of the really powerful things that this play did was it was an epic story about the very nature of America. And at the heart of that story are gay people. And its protagonist, its everyman figure, is an effeminate gay man with AIDS, who at the time, you know, that they were starting to write this, is like sort of one of the most despised overlapping subclasses of people in the United States, right? An effeminate gay man with AIDS. And not only did Tony Kushner make him the center of the play, the heart of the play, the protagonist of the play, you know, our stand-in in the play, no matter what your own identity is. The other thing that he did that's really radical is that Prior Walter, that character, is still alive at the end of the play. And until this play, there really was no major work of drama, literature, or film where the person who had AIDS at the beginning of the story was alive at the end of the story. And the idea that this story could end with that character still alive, even though he's fragile, he's worse off, he might not be alive for that much longer, but that he is alive was a really, really bold statement and a statement of hope that a lot of people needed to hear.
What would you say is the contribution, if you could say it, between this play and people's understanding of what it means to be gay in America?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that this play, in part, you know, by coming to Broadway, by being a success, by being beloved by the intelligentsia, I mean, it's not every play that gets discussed in multiple issues of the New York Review of Books. You know what I mean? It had a, like, really profound effect on shaping the cultural conversation back in a time when we should say it was easier to shape the cultural conversation because there was no internet, no social media, things like that, right? Those kind of monolithic turning of the battleship of our culture, there was a period of time time where that was maybe in some ways easier to do if the right people were on board. But the other thing that I would say is that the play does to the people who see it and the people who are in it the same thing that it does to its characters. There's this kind of mimetic quality because the play is so long, right? It's such an epic experience. And because there's so much about the world packed into it, so much, there's so much thematic density. And because it really takes this, its central characters beat by beat through the process of change and what it is to change and what the nature of change is and how change is inevitable and a necessary part of being alive. To interact with that is to be changed yourself. You can't really go into the wade into those waters without being transformed in some way. At least that's my experience of it. I mean, I'm sure there's people who don't like this play who haven't had that experience of it. You know, it's not magical. It's not the baptismal fount or something, right? But it does have that effect on a lot of people that you just feel on some molecular level like you've been shifted by it, which is something that only great art can really do. Part of me feels like only theater can really do that, but that's because I'm a theater buff. But great art can really do that. And this play, through really being about change itself and the nature of change itself, and guiding you through that process, really has that effect on lots of people.
Well, what does this mean? Angels in America now, does it still have a political message?
Oh boy, does it ever. You know, one of the interesting things was that when we started reporting the article that would turn into this book, Donald Trump Was a Joke, we got about halfway through working on the book and he was the next president of the United States, you know? And that radically changed the book. I think it radically changed the nature of the book. Our interviews with people went from people kind of talking in abstract terms about the relevance of this play today to people talking in direct concrete terms about the relevance of this play today. For a couple of reasons. As I said before, Roy Cohn, who's a character in this play, was Donald Trump's mentor. And Donald Trump learned his tactics of always lash out, always attack, never admit you're wrong, lie when you have to, you know, bludgeon your way through the system. He learned that directly from Roy Cohn. So that's one immediate thing. The other thing I would say is that, you know, as Tony Kushner says in our book, the play was not written at a time of great positive change. The play was written and takes place in a time when things are terrible, but there's glimmers of hope. There's little shoots of grass, you know, peeking through that sort of concrete that's been laid over it. And that is very similar to the time we live in now.
Isaac Butler has been my guest, author of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, an oral history.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks to producer John Shuck of Progressive Spirit. Check out his podcasts at progressivespirit.net. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Francis O'Brien and Seth Eric Cutler, produced with Brian DeShazer, from Janet Mason, Sonia of Disappear Fear, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and John Shuck. Nicholas Payton, Meg Christian, Disappear Fear, and Thomas Newman performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the redesigned thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WOMR Provincetown, Massachusetts, CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, 7LTN Launceston, Tasmania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.